part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com.
Thank you, by the way, for backing the campaign. I noticed that you
Well, I always try and back your stuff. I love your stuff. So I, you know, as I say to everyone, I can't just throw money at every single interview person that I, you know, interviewee that I interview, but I like to help support. So at least if I can throw a little money, at least towards the digital, or, you know, if the print is affordable and stuff like that, I'd try. So, yeah, of course I really like your stuff. So, you know, legitimately.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. It's not just cause you come on the podcast. It's cause I actually, and I know that it launched a little while ago. There's like a week left, right, Ari?
Yeah, we are in the last spurt of this campaign.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, 1 week left.
Well, let's let people know about it. First of all,
yes.
Your name is Ari Gross, right?
That's right.
Got it correct. And my name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. And we have had you on for, previously it was your book Wardens. And then previous to that, it was Awakening, kind of like a Star Trek sort of thing. And like I was saying a little bit before, I mean, I really enjoy your stuff, so it's always a pleasure to have you on. And your current project is called Upkeep, and it's Upkeep number one, right? So there's going to be a number two, a number three, a number four. Is that that's the plan?
Yeah, that's right. Number two, actually, the art for it is in production. I think we're about, not quite half, I say 40% of the way through the book in terms of the black and white art. The script for number three is on its third pass right now. I've got it planned out. The general shape of the story I have planned out for many issues. Mm-hmm. I see this as being like a decades long project for me, writing and creating this thing. I want this to go to like 18 or 20 issues.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah, this is going to be big, because I'll just tell people give people a little background about Upkeep and what it is.
Yeah. Go for it.
So Upkeep is a horror/family drama that takes place in Toronto, sort of set against the current housing crisis that we have in, I guess, everywhere, but specifically because I'm writing here in Toronto.
Yeah.
It's gotten quite bad. Houses are very expensive. I just walked by a $2 million teardown house recently in my neighborhood. It's totally nuts. The house prices have essentially, I think, tripled in the past 20 years.
Yeah.
So I wanted to write a story about that, but make it a very personal story, not just some abstract story about, you know, things are too expensive now. Like, that's not very interesting. I wanted to write a story about a person who has the opportunity, I guess a family rather, who has the opportunity to get their dream house. It's a magical mansion that can give them anything they want that exists in the world. And all it requires is occasional upkeep, which is, you know, find the worst person that you can, a person who's done, you know, the most evil, despicable things, and basically, you know, send them to the house's basement, and who knows what happens there.
So
it's a story about the you know, what would you do? You know, the tagline is like, who would you kill for your dream house? You know,
nice.
What would you do to get the things that you want? And I want this to really, I mean, the major themes for our keeper, some of the major themes are the fact that, you know, anything we have, anything we benefit from is usually at the cost of someone else, if not, you know, the natural world, or, you know, animals, plants, whatever. We live very exploitative lives, you know, the things that, like a t-shirt I'm wearing, I'm happy with this cool t-shirt I'm wearing, but, you know, it's probably made in a place where people paid people, you know, extremely low wages. It was probably, you know, imported here, you know, through a system that is, you know, rife with inequality and corruption. And so, you know, there's this, the things we enjoy, the things we think are great, come at a cost, except the cost is very abstracted from us. It's very far away.
Yeah.
So Upkeep, I want to make that very, I want to like remove that distance. So, you know, Adam, you know, the main, one of the two main protagonists, and I say the person who is probably the main character that we're following the closest in the story, at least in issue one, he has this dream house, but he has to make a sort of a personal, sort of essentially a blood sacrifice to the house. And so it's sort of like, there's no abstraction, there's no distance. It's immediate, it's personal. And I sort of want to, I want to play with those themes as well as, you know, what does it mean to be able to live in a place of ultimate privilege when, you know, everyone else isn't? And what does it mean to raise a family in a place of sort of this kind of secret magical privilege and do that for years and decades? And what does that do for, you know, for kids who grew up in this this different world and but still have to relate to everybody else and, you know, also kind of hide the fact that they live in a magical, magical murder mansion, you know?
So to come back
to your earlier question about how long the series is going to be, I mean, I have the first six issues planned out as a semi sort of coherent arc. I mean, semi-coherent is the fact, like, there's stuff that happens in issue one that sort of plays off and gets resolved in issues five and six. And by the time we're done there, we're ready to move on to a different sort of part of the story. But every year in upkeep, or every issue in upkeep takes place 1 year in the future. So the first year, we have the family, Adam and Yvonne, and their little 6-month-old Tristan move into this house. It's called Garrison Manor. And then every year after is 1, 2, 3, 4 years, etc. So by the time you get to, you know, issue 18, issue 20, their kid is going to be 18, is going to be 20 and ready to, you know, what most kids do, move out of the house.
Yeah.
So it's kind of secretly a story of the kids growing up in this place, but it's foregrounded by being a story of, you know, the parents. So yeah, I want to sort of tell a multi-generational story. And I think doing that by pushing every issue 1 year into the future kind of allows you to do that in kind of a sneaky way. If I were faster, I would maybe make it so, you know, 2 issues a year or something like that. But yeah, I have to be realistic about how many of these I'm actually creating, right?
Sure, sure. As but you mean like Kickstarters or actual like projects? Like, because you, I know you did Wardens and, you know, the other Awakenings or like was like a one shot, right? Like you didn't, and I don't remember if Wardens was going to be like an ongoing thing, right? But
yeah, Wardens is, so Awakening is a one shot.
Yeah.
I actually, I put all my comics on Global Comics earlier today. So I revisited all of them and selecting the frames for doing the frame by frame, panel by panel view.
Yeah.
So I've been staring at Awakening this morning for the first time in like, you know, a while. But yeah, Awakening is a one shot. Wardens is ongoing. Wardens has a six. I wrote drafts for the first six issues, so that's sort of a coherent arc. That's, I'm calling that arc Schmata Business. That's the whole deal with the Schmata. That's
sort of, you know,
begins and ends, and then and by the end of that, you know, if we want to tell a different story with the team, you know, the first six issues is kind of like getting the band together, getting the team together, and then afterwards, you know, you start at a different point. You know, Rachel's not like emotionally and character wise, she's going to be, you know, in a different place than when she was at the very beginning of the story. So it's sort of ripe for a new adventure.
Yeah.
But yeah, just, I don't have the bandwidth to make a million comics at once. Also probably don't have the bank account to make a million comics at once.
Sure.
You know, you have to prioritize these things. And I also definitely don't have the bandwidth to sell a million comics at once, because that is a insane and stressful thing that, I'm looking to explore alternate routes to Kickstarter, because this Kickstarter thing is just, I don't know if I keep doing this twice a year.
That's so interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, that's the thing is, well, where do we go from here? Because we could talk about Kickstarter, but I want to talk about your project. I mean, it sounds like really, I like the idea of you approaching this from a personal, you know, perspective. Cause I mean, like I live in Los Angeles and the housing prices here are like insane. Like it is absolutely crazy. And I grew up in New Jersey and New York and seeing what apartments go for, like in Manhattan or even Brooklyn or like Queens, I'm like, oh my God, like that's insanity. And you know, between you and me, the only way that we have good jobs, like me and my wife, but I mean, like we got help from like, you know, my wife's family, like to be able to purchase our home. Like it wasn't just like we put our own money into it, but we needed help. So we were fortunate in that. And I know that that is a thing that I benefit from. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's a conscious thing every day that I realize, and that I know that other people don't, you aren't fortunate enough to have experienced or be, have that as well, especially being in LA and seeing friends or creatives and stuff like that struggling in what the entertainment industry is going through right now. So like for you, I'm assuming, like, for some reason, I think that Americans just think like Canada is this amazing wonderland where healthcare is free and there are no problems and people dance with bears and, you know, in the woods or whatever, like, you know what I mean? But it sounds like that whatever I'm experiencing or what we're experiencing in a lot of areas in the US is happening in your country as well. And that you are kind of, you know, seeing that as detrimental to you and your family, right?
Yeah. I mean, so Canada's kind of funny, since most Americans often, you know, the stereotype is like, oh, you got houses? I thought y'all lived in igloos. Like, that was, you know, in the 90s, that was, well, we got a lot, you know, but I mean, it's like most Canadians are actually urban. Most Canadians live in cities, just like number wise, statistics wise.
Sure.
And the cities are just, you know, modern North American cities. Like they were, like Toronto goes back to, you know, the 1800s. Montreal is quite old. I grew up in Montreal, so it's quite a different city than Toronto. I mean, there's also, you know, French English versus Toronto, which is extremely multicultural at this point. Uh-huh. Most people in Toronto are not born in Toronto. And I think at this point, most people in Toronto are not from Canada.
Oh.
Like Toronto is, I think, a majority immigrant city, or if it's not majority, it's like about 50%. So it's a very different flavor of city than a lot of other places. And Vancouver is quite similar in the sense that Vancouver is, well, ethnically a little different than Toronto, but still a very, the main immigrants to Canada and Vancouver are typically Chinese, Indian, like South Asian. And there's like, I go to Vancouver often because my wife's family lives there. She grew up in Edmonton, but her family is Chinese and they came to Canada initially to Vancouver. And so they retired back in Vancouver. And it's a major, huge city with, you know, a very like multi-ethnic population and massive, massive housing issues because there's only so far you can go.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of other, the housing crisis has a number of reasons behind it. I mean, increasing populations to cities is one thing. There's the fact that there's a whole bunch of like very specific developer issues specific to like Canada and Toronto, which are like extremely boring to talk about to anybody else, but like,
sure,
kind of matter a lot. But at the end of the day, you have high demand for living in a place and people want to live in these, you know, massive urban environments. But it's just finding the way to do that with a growing city is really hard. I mean, the cost of living crisis in general is like, I just went to the grocery store and every time I go to the grocery store and I come back, I like, what? That's how much? I don't believe you. You know, like,
yeah,
like that goes on. That's like a weekly thing for me. For some reason, I'm still like shocked at this, the fact that everything's like going up. But housing in particular, because, you know, most people still think of it as their primary investment, as their primary thing that they need to put money into to, and that eventually they're going to get money out of as well. That I think the idea of owning a house as an investment, as a place to live, has also had quite an effect on the housing market, which is of course how people have looked at it for decades. But anyway, I'm just sort of getting rambly at this point.
No. Yeah, I mean,
it's not just America. It's Well, I was going to say you can write the same story. Not the same story exactly, but a very similar story, like set in Brooklyn or something, or set, you know, Manhattan. Like I could have written about so many other places. It just sort of happens that I live in Toronto and the issues that I see are quite acute to Toronto. And, you know, as someone who, you know, I'm in a house right now and I've looked at housing prices and I know people who are looking to move. And like, I see this stuff a lot, partly because I think it's, you know, the, my age group, you know, my demographics, you know, I'm 41. So a lot of people I know are in their 30s and early 40s, which is the time when people typically look to buy their first house or to move if they had a condo or something before.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, these are issues that, like, I probably wouldn't be writing about if I were 60.
Yeah.
You know, just at a different stage in my life. But I do think these are super important issues for everyone because the cost of living, especially the cost of a house, is a major effect on, like, everyone because everybody needs to live somewhere. And even if you're not looking to buy a house, you're looking to rent a house.
Yeah.
If it costs you $1,000 to have a bed in some guy's kitchen, yeah, which I shit you not, is like you see ads for that kind of thing.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
It's like, come on, man. Like that's got huge effects on like everybody. So
yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing is like, I mean, you're in Canada and it's so funny because like, there's a lot of people in the US who mistakenly are like, yeah, we're all, you know, one, it's all one big continent or it's all one big, you know, we're all brothers. But it's always interesting to me to know that the same things are happening in other countries that are happening in my country. Like, you know what I mean? And it's interesting to see that your government or, you know, whatever, you know, the system is up there is having as just as a hard a time dealing with what the housing situation as the US or California is like. And that's the thing is like, it seems like nobody cares to come up with a solution or can come up with a solution. It's like nobody wants to do rent control, right? It's like, why not? Yeah. Like, you know, we should be doing rent control, like in my opinion, and, you know, and so that people can move into a house. But it's like then, you know, there's just like so many crazy issues like that people undercut themselves, like, because I mean, you always hear like, oh, we should do rent control, and then there's always the one dude is like, well, what if I end up buying a house and I want to rent it out, and then like, and then, you know, and so it's just it's all compounded by craziness and insanity and what ifs, and yeah, I mean, I'm sorry that that's happening up there in Canada as well.
Yeah, it's there are no, unfortunately, there's no super easy solutions. Yeah. In Canada, we do have, at least in Toronto, I don't know if this is all Ontario, I think it is, but I'm not sure. There is a certain amount that the rent can go up every year. So let's say it's like 2.5% or something like that.
Yeah.
So there are some kind of things, but it's not like rent control, like tenement in Lower East Side in New York or something where people have been paying prices since like the 70s, you know, like,
that's not
here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a whole big issue, and I'm sure there's like many actual devoted podcasts to just discussing the
economics. Yeah, situation. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I've listened to those. And I would suggest that people listen to those too if you're sort of in this situation. I mean, the thing that stands out to me the most when you described your premise is it sounds very like Tales from the Crypt. Like it sounds very like kind of old school horror sort of thing. Like very much like people kind of going into this with the best intentions for themselves or their family and being like, oh, so what? We're not gonna, you know, we're hurting bad people. Like we're not hurting good people, like good people like us. But I would imagine, and I don't want any spoilers, I haven't read the project or seen it. I've only seen the Kickstarter page, which is what, you know, other people can see if they go to Kickstarter and look for Upkeep, number one. But yeah, I'm assuming that you're a fan of that sort of thing, like horror or Tales from the Crypt or Twilight Zone sort of thing.
Yeah. As you recall, because you read Awakening,
yeah,
and some of my other shorts, I don't know if you read any of those, but there's definitely a twisty sort of Tales from the Crypt, Twilight Zone, Alan Moore's Future Shocks kind of like, you know, a vibe to a lot of those. Like I really do like that. The thing with Upkeep is because it's going to go on for a while, I don't want a kind of story where like, you know, there's a massive twist at the end of issue one and it's going to like that. That's it. You know, like often if you have a twist in a story, it usually changes something in a super fundamental way. You know, a twist is like a joke. You know, there's like you're thinking it's one thing, but then it's something else. Mm. For Upkeep issue one, I don't think there's any massive twists. I mean, there's turns, but there's no like, oh, it turns out this is something else all along. Because I want to lead into the horror part, and I want to lay that out longer. So the kind of ambiguity, like not to spoil, you know, too much, but at some point, pretty soon, like after, you know, within the first few years, Adam starts, you know, referring to the house. It's called Garrison Manor because it's always across Garrison Creek, which is a local a former river that is now a sewer in Toronto, but yeah. There's sort of a history of that I want to fold into that. So he starts calling the house Gary and anthropomorphizing it. And at some point the house is going to start, you know, trying to communicate with him, or is it, or is that just all in his head? And so I want to have these longer sort of buildup of tension, a kind of a years long, you know, sort of descent for Adam in particular, into like, you know, at first he's kind of happy and, you know, works out, but then, you know, maybe things don't work out as they want to, and he overcomes that and he goes back. Like something that plays with the character, and he gets to sink his teeth into the, am I really doing the right thing? You know, is this something that's going to be good? And what is this doing to me?
Yeah.
You know what, you know, it's the sort of the, I mean, it's the classic, you know, you set out to do, you know, what is it? You know, you have to become a monster to fight a monster, or, you know, you know, if you go after revenge, dig two graves, or that kind of, you know, like it affects the person who's doing it, you know, so he might see himself as doing, you know, obviously a selfish thing for his family, but he's ridding the world of bad people. But what does that actually do to him? And what are the larger implications for that and his family? And no, I mean, in a material sense, but also sort of in a moral and character sense, you know, yeah. What does it mean to you if you think of, you know, if you're essentially a serial killer, like obviously you think of death a little differently than if you're a guy who hasn't killed anyone.
Yeah.
I would assume, I don't know, I'm not a serial killer. So
who knows? Yeah. But let me ask you this. Is it sort of a situation where one person knows about the house and the rest of the family doesn't, or do they all go into it kind of together, like saying like, this is what we're going to do for our family? Obviously the child or the baby, because it looks like, at least from the cover, that they have like a toddler or an infant.
Yeah. He's like a 6 month old or something.
Yeah. And it seems like, is it like where one parent knows and the other one doesn't, and this is just what I've got to do for my family? Or do the husband and wife sort of go in it together, or is that too spoilery?
No, I'll tell you, they both go in with open eyes.
Got it.
When they initially get the house, it's not really explained to them what they have to do, but oh. They sort of figure it out. But Adam is the master of the house. That is the title that is bestowed onto him because he is the person who actually, I guess, put in the bid and received the house. The house abides one master. So that's a power dynamic and a power imbalance, which I think is something I want to play with.
Yeah, yeah.
And so his wife, Yvonne, she knows what's going on. Adam knows what's going on. But it's Adam's responsibility. It's sort of he's the house guy, where Yvonne was previously the, you know, the former breadwinner in the family. You know, she had the job and everything. Adam was looking for a job. But this becomes the thing that he has to do. And yeah. There's going to be a bit of who knows, who doesn't know, because they're not just going to live in this house for 20 years and not interact with society. They want to live a life in Toronto. They want to live a life where they go places and see people, and their kids go to school and stuff like that. And there's going to be another person who moves into the house in a future issue who does know. And there's going to be some people who find out about the house who won't know. And eventually the kids will have to find out. You know, right now, Tristan's growing up in this nice little environment where he has a magical house and everything's great. But, you know, at some point, he's going to have to figure out what's going on. And that's going to be a whole thing, which, you know, when do you realize that, you know, your parents are a little different than you might have thought they were? Or maybe they're not a little different. Maybe they're, you know, maybe not a little different, learning new levels to people, you know, which is a natural thing as you grow up and you see your parents and you realize that, you know, they're people too. They're not your idols. I kind of want to play with that a little bit in future issues. So I'm sort of setting all this up where a lot of people, or not a lot of people know, but like the main characters, like Adam and Yvonne, know for sure. And then as we get more people come into the story, some know, some don't, some, you know, well, you'll see.
Yeah. Earlier, it sounds like you're, at least with the story, or at least with the first issue, you're sort of not like M. Night Shyamalan, you know, you're not dealing with like twists and stuff like that, which has sort of become a hallmark of like the horror, you know, genre in the past, you know, whatever, ever since, you know, what was that, the Bruce Willis movie, his first movie where it's like
Sixth Sense.
Yeah, the Sixth Sense, where people like got all excited about like twists and turns, or possibly, you know, even Hitchcock and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
oh, yeah.
But
I mean, I love a good twist.
Yeah, but, I mean, well, I love Alfred Hitchcock. I love part of the thing that we're doing, that we always do is horror movies for October, and we're starting to record those episodes, and Psycho 3 it was like one of the picks. So now I have to go back, and I've never seen the sequels, and I'm just like, okay. But I love Alfred.
No, there was a third Psycho.
There's a fourth one, believe it or not. Anyway, so those are coming in October, but I love Alfred Hitchcock, but there are different kinds of horror. And it seems to me like what most people associate with horror is a thriller, but you are approaching this in a different way. Right? Like where it's not twists and turns, but it seems to be, is it a slow burn? Is it a thing of like descent into madness? Like what would you sort of compare it to as far as like, you know, so people might get an idea of what you're doing? Because this sounds very interesting to me in that it is not sort of like the kind of like cheap twist or the, hey, we were this and now we're that, like sort of thing. This sounds, like I said, like a descent into madness or what did we do? Or like, I didn't know what I was getting into. What are some of your thoughts on that versus like the twist? I mean, you mentioned it a little earlier, but why take this approach?
So first of all, I do want to say that I do intend to have some twists in the story, but
sure,
just
okay.
Not in issue one. Issue one's like the setup. And I feel like, I mean, I could have told an issue one where they get a great house and then they find out that it's a murder mansion. You know,
got it.
That would have been a twist. But that, I don't want to sell the story that way because, you know, I want to tell people right up front that like, this is what it's about. This is what, you know, lay the general mechanics of the story out.
Well,
on
it's also hard to sell a story of like, hey, there's a family and they bought a house. Like,
exactly,
and then it's
right?
Like,
yeah.
What else? Like, yeah. So anyway, go on. Although that, who knows, like we've been talking about with everything that we're all going through, maybe that story would sell too. Like, how did I get a house or that sort of thing? But anyway, go on.
Yes, this, I definitely do see this as more of a slow burn. And I think a lot of this is the fact that it's not just a horror series. I'm writing what I'm calling a horror/family drama. So it's really going to look at the interpersonal dynamics of the people in the house. It's going to look at their relations to how they deal with, you know, the outside world. It's going to be more of something, or it is more of something that is dealing with like issue two is about like one of the main issues is like, you know, they got to do upkeep again. So there's that, and that, you know, it might go a little differently than the first time. But the other main story is Yvonne is trying to find daycare for her kid, who's now like almost two. And daycare is really hard to find in Toronto. And what do you do if daycare, you know, is a difficult thing to get? Like, I want to deal with these like almost like very, you know, like 30 to 40, like something year old, like early adult, or so I guess early parent to mid parent to like later parent issues.
Sure.
And more of like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's more of a middle class book that deals with sort of the middle class issues of like, how do you exist as
domesticity or that sort of thing? Like,
yeah, domesticity. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Where Wardens, as you read, is a very working class book. Wardens deals with like, you know, people living in like a poor immigrant neighborhood dealing with like, they're not trying to, no one in Wardens is trying to buy a house. Like, that's not something that's on the menu for Rachel. Like, she can't afford a house. Like, she's like saving up to like rent a place that's not in a free place, where, you know, these people are at a different stage of their life, sort of at a different economic stage and also a different time. I mean, they're living now as opposed to the 1920s. I don't know much about the housing prices in the 1920s.
Sure.
But, you know, that would have been that's a different story.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, because Garrison Manor, this house that's just always across Garrison Creek, I don't want to have a origin story for it, at least not an origin story I tell anytime soon. I mean, I have like lots of ideas and whatnot, but like, I want the mystery of the matter to be something that is slowly teased out, slowly discovered, so that you can tell stories about, you know, in the 20s, the 40s, in the 1800s, in the 1700s, or whenever you want, that deal with this same kind of like, you know, there's always been a house here, or, you know, as long as anyone can remember, there's this magical house that will give you what you want if only you give it what it wants. So the house itself, I think you can use as a vehicle for telling those kind of one-off horror stories, you know, either twisty sort of horror stories, or, descent into darkness kind of horror stories, or whatever you want. I'd like the idea that the premise I can go and then take and tell slightly different types of stories, but this story with this family feels like it's got to be a slow question of what it means to being raised in a place of like secret privilege, but with a darkness underneath it all. So yeah, I want the feel to be different than a lot of other horror stories, which I think also has made it kind of hard to market, because I've sort of marketed as a horror story, but it's not like a straight horror story. I've written some things that are more close to being straight horrors or shorts, and this just isn't that. And I think it's more interesting because it's not, but we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's face it, even just trying to be a parent and keep, you know, food on the table, that could be a horror story in and of itself, and probably more relatable to your average reader than anything else, right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, one of my, if people ask me like an X like meets Y sort of pitch for this thing, I usually say it's kind of like a Little Shop of Horrors meets, I don't know, insert like housing crisis reference here. Where it's Little Shop of Horrors, which was, I watched that obsessively as a kid. I was so into
that. Oh my God,
and
such a great.
Halfway through writing Upkeep, I realized I'm just writing like Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
You know, like, what would you do for the thing, you know, that can give you whatever you want, right? You know, it's a classic, like, tale as old as time, right? You know,
give
up a part of yourself, or, you know, part of your morality for something you can benefit from.
Sure.
And it's more like in that tradition, I think, than more conventional horror. The kind of the horror crossovers, the horror dramas, the horror, you know, or just the tragedies. You know, there's so many tragedies where someone achieves something at a great cost to themselves. That's kind of what this is, more so than a straight up, you know, like, boo, you know?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting to me, I mean, you mentioned before, you don't necessarily have like an origin for the house kind of like laid out exactly or concretely like in your head. That seems kind of ballsy to me, or it seems kind of like, I mean, what's his face did with Lost, where it's like, you know,
JJ.
Yeah. JJ Abrams did with Lost, where it's like, yeah, there was no real plan, like at least in the beginning, like, you know what I mean? But, any thoughts on that? Like, cause I mean, it sounds like the origin isn't necessary. What's important is that it exists, and that it is this thing that helps this family, but will only help them if it gets what it wants. Like, it doesn't sound like, you know, it's kind of like the zombies in like George Romero's like zombie. You don't know why they came back. They kind of allude to maybe it was radiation or something, but it changes across the movies, and who gives a shit? It's not really important, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm a massive fan of the who gives a shit is not really important. If it's not really that part of the thing.
Yeah.
I do like, so just to be clear, I don't have a single origin story that I've nailed down in my head. I have several different options that I've been playing around with.
Yeah.
And I think what I'm going to do is, do you remember the issue of Batman where like a bunch of kids are around a campfire and tell stories about Batman?
Yeah.
I want to do an issue like that shows across the era three or four different people tell stories about, you know, to their kids, people who are living in Garrison Manor. So let's say someone living in like 1920 or whatever, you know, their daughter asks like, daddy, you know, how did this house come to be? And so, you know, that daddy has to have an explanation. And so I want to play with like different possible origins where some people living in the house think that it's, you know, the fact that this house tells them they have to, you know, sacrifice bad people. This house is an instrument of God. This house is a good thing. It's a blessing, you know, or some other people think that this house is a gateway to hell or something, or, you know, different ideas about what it actually could be.
Yeah.
I do have a specific kind of headcanon-ish thing right now, but I don't want to put that on paper because I want to give it time for that to get fleshed out. And I think it doesn't add anything to the story of Adam Yvonne and, you know, their kids and the family that grows up in this house and this in this particular comic series. It doesn't add anything if I tell them the specific origin of how this house came to be.
Sure.
But I don't think that that's necessarily something I want to shy away from ever dealing with. It's not like I don't want to say we're never going to explain this. Like, we might never explain this, or you might explain it, but when you explain it, I don't know. Like, have you read the – there's a recent series by Tom Taylor called Seven Secrets.
No.
Which it's a pretty fun series. It's there's this mystical organization, and everyone's carrying around briefcases, and they all contain seven secrets. And in the very final issue, or maybe the second last, you finally discover what the secrets are and why they are and what the whole deal is. You get the backstory.
Yeah.
And it is nice to get the backstory. And it does help explain things, and it fills in some gaps. Like, at one point, someone opens up a briefcase and all of Switzerland gets destroyed. I'm like, why did that happen? Like, that's weird.
Yeah.
And, you know, then it's kind of like explained, whether or not you like the explanation or not, you know, I think have that much to do with the character arc of the story. It's more of a plot thing. So I want to really focus on the character. And if I ever deal with any of the like origins of the house, spinoffs, one shots, you know, whatever the equivalent of an annual is, a decadal, you know, like all my comics are annuals is like what I like to joke, you know?
Yeah.
But I'd like the idea that I can tell that if I want to, but I don't need to tell that for this story. And in fact, even in issue two, Adam's thinking about maybe I should look into the history of the house. And Yvonne's like, I don't think we should do that. But she does that for a character-based reason. And, you know, because it's like, if you really find out what the house is, could you live with yourself living there? You know, if you find out, like, it's, you know, if you find out what it actually costs, you know, to buy a t-shirt, you know, the exact human and, you know, environmental toll, would you buy that t-shirt? And I kind of want them to be okay with the ignorance, with the ambiguity, because that helps them move forward and live there. Because otherwise, yeah, if they knew the truth, maybe it would crush them and maybe they couldn't live there anymore.
Well, it's interesting. It also sounds like a bit of an allegory of like what you take on when you buy a house, right? Like the debt, the sort of like, and then on top of that, the fixing that you have to do, that you have to take care of. Because I know when I first moved into our townhome that we bought when we were younger, it was like, oh, wait, what? Like dues? Like, wait, oh, I have to pay for the sink? You know, like I grew up in a city. Like I grew up in a city environment or in rentals like my whole life. So we always had a landlord, someone else to come and fix that. Yeah. And it's like the price of owning a home is literally, and then is literally that you have to fix everything. You have to pay for everything. Like that is the added cost. And then on top of that, it's also sort of like the sort of idea of like, yeah, if I need to own a home, I need to have a job. Like, and then the job that I have to keep, it has to be something that I like for years and years. Or, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's all the sort of like financial costs, the emotional costs, like everything that goes with owning an actual home and being responsible for a mortgage or payments or whatever, that a lot of people don't look at when they first are like trying to take that big step. And then once you get into it, you're like, oh fuck, like I can't just quit my job. Like, oh fuck, like I can't, like, you know what I mean? Like that sort of thing. And it's interesting that you're sort of adding murder on top of that. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's called upkeep for a reason. It's all about the things that you require to live at your place.
Yeah.
That's like, it's literally right there in the title. It's funny, as I was like a month ago, our basement flooded and I was getting ready for the Kickstarter campaign. I was just like, yep, now I have to move all my comics into a different thing. And I was keeping a bunch of comics in like a cardboard box in a corner that's prone to water damage, which is terrible idea.
Yeah.
Including like a lot of issues of, some of the issues of Warded. So some of those are a little waterlogged now.
Yeah, that happened. Like, we got a lot of rains in California, and that happened in my home office where we got some water and it hurt some books. And I was like, oh, man. But anyway, go on.
Everything off the floor, everything in plastic tubs. I've learned my lesson.
Yeah.
Too late, mind you, but you got to learn at some point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like writing the story and living in a house and seeing what it needs to like we had to fix the basement because we had flooding, and everyone's having flooding in Toronto because our city's not made for the amount of water that we get, and it wasn't made for the population. So like all these, like anyone I know who has a home, or many people who, you know, rent as well, like, even if you're not paying for it, like you still have all these little housing issues and like,
yeah,
things that you didn't know, things that like come up to bite you in the ass that are like, what do you mean? I got to like, what's tuck pointing? I got a tuck point. What the hell is that? I got to pay someone to come and like smear stuff on my bricks to make sure like water doesn't come into my house. It's like, yeah, you got to do that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you either have to learn how to do it or you got to pay someone to do it. Like that's,
yeah,
it's just, it's upkeep. And that's, I mean, I don't know, a lot of this has just come out of like the fact that, you know, I'm in a house now, and it's, you know, this is the first house I've had, you know, since I like grew up in a house. I've always rented before, but we got this place about 10 years ago. We got very lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, yes, yeah, it's like, it was kind of insane that we got it. We didn't think we were going to be able to get a house, but we managed to get this one, and just because of probably location, you know, some downsides that were downsides for other people, but aren't for us just because of our lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it's and like, we love it. Like, I love this home so much.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, like if someone said, hey man, you can have this great home, but you might have to kill a guy to like, you know, live here, I think that would be like a real conversation.
Yeah, I think so. Would it be a good, that's so funny that you're like that, I might have to have a conversation, whereas I'd be like, yeah, sorry, can't do that. Like, you know, it's, yeah. Ari's a murderer, everyone. He's going to kill you for his house.
I mean, only the bad guys. That's the thing too. I want this house to be that. So one of the sticks is that the longer you get, the worse the person is, the more bad things they've done, that you sacrifice that person to the house, the longer your house is nice to you. So the house doesn't want to eat or want to, let's say, consume good people. And so there's this kind of self-rationalization that kind of creeps up into this that makes the story. Like, I felt like if I thought like, would it be more interesting story if the house is like, the better the person is, you know, the longer the house gives you. But I don't think that's as interesting as this, because this allows people to say, allows Adam to say, listen, I'm only sacrificing the bad people, you know, like I'm going on dark web murder for hire websites and getting hitmen and like, this person's just like killed five guys and he's a scam artist. Like,
yeah,
you know, clearly that's, you know, fine if we remove him from society, and, you know, and the worse the person is, you know, you might get 2 years or 3 years instead of, you know, 1 year or 4 months or whatever out of the house. So, I like the fact that there's this sort of this moral dimension to it as well, which also, I guess, makes me, you have to then say that there exists, if not an objective, at least a house specific subjective concept of morality, which is something I sort of want to explore. Like, what does that mean with the house? Like, actually, does that actually, like, there, it means there is actually a good and a bad thing, that you, morality exists in some real way.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's all the kind of metaphysical questions that you can get into, which I want to raise but not necessarily dwell on. Because I want to keep this character focused. I want to keep it about the family growing up in the house, the people that move in the house, the people they interact with, their friends, the secrets that people have to keep from people who are close to them, that kind of thing. That's sort of what I want to get out of the series. Just telling fun stories about a murderer mansion.
Yeah. And we all know now that you would kill somebody to own a home. Anyway, it would,
I guess I would.
I'm sure a lot of people would at this point. Will every issue be centered around the awful thing that they have to do, or do you have it plotted out different times of the year? Like, when, like, I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out. It sounded like you wanted to do each issue would look at them at one point in like a year. And so, but it might not necessarily have to deal with the act of murder that they have to commit. Right. Like
yes, yeah, that's right. So issue two, like I was saying, it's more around, daycare and murder. But issue three
be murder.
is, It can be, yeah. Issue 3 has no upkeep in it. Issue 3 has to deal with the birth of their second kid. Nice. Sophie, they're having another kid. So it has to deal with that. And one of the main rules for the house is someone has to be at the house. Someone from the family of the master of the house has to be in the house for every dawn. No exceptions. And so issue 3 is, what if, because, you know, someone's having a kid and they're in a hospital, like, what if that deadline is missed? And what does that do?
Oh, wow.
So that's that's more like birth horror, which, I mean, knowing a bunch of people who have gone through extremely scary birth situations is one of those things I wanted to bring into a comic which I don't think people tell a lot of comics about, you know, birth horror, because quite frankly, it's not a thing that, like, I think a lot of people really want to write about.
Yeah.
Pregnancy horror gets written a little more about, but, you know, if you have a plan for having a kid and everything goes wrong, because in this case, because something has happened that's, you know, supernatural, but that's scary. Like, that's legit scary. And, so that deals with that. And there's no upkeep in issue 4 and, in issue 3. Wow. So there doesn't have to be murder in every issue, but every issue has to have, for me, because it's a horror family drama, has to have something that propels the story of the family forward, and it has to have something that is scary or creepy or morally complex or has some underlying darkness to it.
Yeah.
So it's not just a series of, you know, like, every issue a guy kills a guy and throws him in the basement or something like that. Like, that, I think that would be a boring story. I think it's much more interesting if that's just sort of a thing that they have to do, or specifically, I guess Adam has to do. It's sort of his kind of responsibility, and it's kind of in the background. It's foregrounded in the beginning of the story, and then it goes to the background, and then it comes into the story, you know, foreground, background, as the story needs it. As Adam needs to, you know, either make a choice, or, you know, maybe it goes wrong, or someone finds out about it. You know, it comes into the story at some point when it becomes more meaningful.
Yeah. Is Adam the one that has to commit the actual, like, lead the person to the, is he, because he's the primary kind of, like, what you said, like, maybe, was it master of the house or something? Or, like, because he signed the deed or whatever. Is he the one that has to, or can it be anyone in the family?
It can be anyone, but it's his job, basically.
Okay.
I don't think it has to be him. And I don't, in the future, I might, you know, I'll play around with that, especially as the kids get older and
sure.
the kids start having, you know, perhaps some dark thoughts themselves and wonder if, you know, maybe some tormentor might be better off not being around. And, you know, maybe they want to think about that. But at this point, it's, you know, in every relationship, there's a division of labors and responsibilities.
Sure.
And in our house, I'm the guy who deals with not all the house stuff, but some of the house stuff. And my wife kind of deals with some other house stuff. And it's sort of like, naturally falls on our areas of interest and expertise, and I'm handy with doing one thing, but she's more handy with something else.
Yeah,
I want this to be kind of like he's sort of on the hook, and it's kind of his responsibility to get it done. Yvonne could do it, but he doesn't want her to do it. Also, he wants to take this on because he sees this as, I mean, at the beginning of the comic, he's sort of in a he's graduated from university, but he can't find a job, and he's kind of spinning his wheels. And this gives him a sense of purpose and a sense of sort of self, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I guess purpose is the best way to put it. This is his thing. And so part of it, this being his thing, is that it has to, you know, it has to be him that does it, at least as far as sort of he sees it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want other people to necessarily have this burden. He feels this is like, you know, everyone gets to benefit from him, but he, because he's the master of the house, he sort of feels emotionally responsible for upkeep.
Got it. So let me wrap this up by asking you, I mean, earlier on, you mentioned a little bit about Kickstarter. Like, what is going on there where you're thinking of, like, trying to find other avenues? Because, I mean, it seems like you've been pretty, you know, kind of consistent with doing Kickstarters. But what is it? Is it just the pressure of it? Is it the anxiety of it? Is it like, or like, what is it that is like kind of making you go, this might not be the best route for me?
So this is my third Kickstarter campaign in, I think it's like about 2.5 years. I did Awakening February 2023, Wardens February 2024. And this is, you know, half a year after Wardens.
Yeah.
I think part of this is me trying to figure out the best way to get the most eyeballs on a book without having to create a sense. So what Kickstarter does is it creates a sense of, it's a ticking clock. And if you have a ticking clock, if you have a sense of urgency, people will then support a project more than if you had an open-ended thing. If this was like, hey, whenever you want, buy a copy of Upkeep, people might say, cool, I'll do that whenever I feel like it. But okay. If you say, hey, 24 hours closing, last chance, otherwise it's not going to make it, you know, then like that causes people, the sense of urgency and the ticking clock causes people to act.
Yeah.
So I think Kickstarter is good for that. But I feel like the second Kickstarter in a year, going back to people 6 months after and being like, hey, I've got a total different thing. I'm not kind of seeing the same interest that I was. And I think it might be because it's too frequent. It might be the price for all I know. I don't know. It could be the fact that it's in September or August, September rather than February when people, you know, are somewhere else. It could be the fact that, you know, maybe there's a lot more comics or the comic scene on Kickstarter has changed a bit since I did it before. But I just feel like it's kind of emotionally draining. I don't really enjoy screaming at people and making people feel money. I love talking about my work. I like discussing it with you. I like discussing it with lots of people. But the sort of the, okay, now I'm going to have 3 weeks where I have to just like spam people and like be very active in trying to promote this thing. And if it works, if it doesn't work, you know, do I, you know, if it's like 80%, do I top it up? Do I even get to 80%? You know, would I want to, like what would I do if I have 24 hours left? And, you know, this is at 70%, you know, with like his, but 50 backers, but maybe I know 40 of them, you know, like,
yeah,
I don't know. I'm kind of like, I feel like I'm getting a little over these sort of like personal questions of like, what do you do if you're like, you know, you're not blowing it out of the water, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out what the best way to do this is, because I want to create physical comics and put them in stores or share them with people and go to cons and market them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that the all or nothing nature of Kickstarter, which I do think the all or nothing nature is actually a good thing for hitting your goals and increasing funding.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that's like just good for my, I don't know, mental well-being and general levels of stress.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, it's one of the reasons why, I mean, I don't know if you know, but I mean, I have my own like little web comic that, you know, I do whenever I have time. But if I had to be on a schedule, like even if it was a yearly schedule, like for me mentally, I just, because of what my day job and what my family situation and stuff, I know I'm more than self-aware enough to know that that's just not good for me. Like, you know what I mean? And it's interesting that I interview a lot of people over the years, and you meet some people who struggle with Kickstarter, and then you meet some people who are just like, they're just fine with it. They're just like, great, this is the way my life is going and stuff like that. And I mean, I can tell you that from what I have seen come from you, it is not the quality of your product, because I've really enjoyed the stuff that you've done, particularly the last one. I mean, I like both of them, but Wardens, I just loved. I thought it was like great.
And, thank you.
You know, and so I think that like what you're doing at least is solid. And I totally know where you're coming from, because I've talked to other creators, you know, when the interview is over and it's like, oh man, like I'm wiped out. Like, you know, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's not an easy thing. And it's why I've never done it, despite people being like, Christian, at least, you know, you have a little thing, just do it. And I'm like, dude, I gotta compartmentalize. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I know October's coming, and that's when everyone's gonna launch like all their Kickstarters, and it's just like, oh my God, I'm already kind of like booked up for that month. So I'm trying to figure out how to help people who have Kickstarters versus the people that I'm interviewing, like, you know, what that I've interviewed in the past. So yeah, it's crazy time. It's just, and it seems to be seasonal. It seems to be like right before the holidays, like people are like Kickstarter, 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 or like right maybe after Christmas or something, like Kickstarter, Kickstarter. And they all launch at the same time and everyone's doing it at the same time. I'm like, guys, give each other room. Like there's too much, you know what I mean? And not cheap.
It's a crowded space.
Yeah.
It's a crowded space. And it's also a space that just looking at the things that succeed, I'm not sure, I think the stories I like are, I mean, good. I write them because I like them. And I think they're, I'm not saying that other things like Kickstarter necessarily bad, but I'm pleased with the work that I do. And even the stuff that I go, like I went back to Awakening today and I'm looking at it, I'm saying, oh, this could be better, that could be better. But like, sure. I still kind of like it. Like, I'm still happy that I did it. I still feel it's a good expression of the type of story that I wanted to tell.
Yeah.
But it's just, there's got to be a way to do this without like spending all my time like focusing on the campaign itself, and more focusing on the thing. Like I would love to spend all my time, I think most creatives, maybe to generalize, many creatives would like to spend their time doing the creative work and not focusing on the marketing work.
Yeah,
the Kickstarter and stuff, you have to spend a lot of time on the marketing, which I'm not opposed to, but I find that the amount of time I spend on the marketing is kind of disproportionate to the amount of returns I see and the interest on it.
Got it.
Like not like the interest amongst, my early thought on Kickstarter, like if I wanted to make a Kickstarter comic that would sell, I would make Smut. I would make something with like giant boobs. I was like jokingly like thinking like maybe I should just do a naked version of like the cover of Upkeep and see if that's
I've seen people switch. They were doing like kids books and then all of a sudden it's like, guess what? I'm doing a sex book. And I'm just like, wow. Like that is just the obvious, like that is just like, okay, this is what sells. I'm frustrated with my stuff not selling. Let's just do that. Like I've seen it. I've literally seen at least one or two or three cases. And that's the thing is I have nothing wrong with that, but you know, porn is free. Like, you know, and I know that there's a market, you know, for that sort of thing, you know, and that's fine. Everyone, you know, go do their own thing. But it is to me like a little bit like, oh really? Like those are the books that are blowing it out instead of like to me, it's kind of heartbreaking when I see something like a comic book legend that I used to read in the 80s. And they're like, they're doing their own personal project and that project is struggling. And I'm like, look, this guy is like literally a comic book. Like, what are you doing? Like, right. You know what I mean? And I hear you. It's weird and it's frustrating. So not to put like one crowdfunding thing against the other, but from what I hear, Zoop is a sort of thing that kind of takes care of a lot of that stuff. So you don't have to, they might take a little bit of a larger chunk, but, and again, I'm not anti Kickstarter. I'm not pro Indiegogo. I'm not, you know what I mean? Everyone do whatever you want, but just for somebody like you, who's expressing the frustrations that you're expressing, it seems like Zoop might be a thing to look into.
After this campaign, I've told myself I'm not going to look into any alternatives until this is done. I'm like, give it a week and figuring out what to do.
Yeah.
But I have seen things on Zoop. I think I backed some stuff on Zoop.
Yeah, me too.
It looks nice and friendly. I don't know exactly what the benefits or the costs are compared to, like, I need to do like a personal research deep dive into that.
Absolutely.
But I'm definitely open to alternatives. I mean, the one thing about Kickstarter is the fact that it's all or nothing means that you have to like, you know, bang a big old drum for, you know, a month or so and get everyone excited about this thing, you know, and if that doesn't happen, then the thing doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Where I'm much happier. Like I know I'm not going to make my money back for Upkeep number one, because I know how much it costs to make this comic. I have all the receipts and I can tell you right now that the amount I'm asking on Kickstarter is not going to cover it. I think I have even on the bottom of the very page, that little pie chart, the Pac-Man-y pie chart.
I hear that a lot.
Where I'm asking for covers, you know, like a quarter to a third of the total cost of creating this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've been doing a lot of like, okay, well, if I'm not going to make the money back for, especially the early issues, you know, is this basically just a loss leader? And if it's a loss leader, then why am I spending all my time worrying about making back a relatively small proportion of this rather than just printing the comic and just going to like they're just trying to get it out there anyway, and just saying, if I don't get an extra, you know, $1,000 or whatever, that is kind of fine because it's just one more extra thousand that I'm not going to
recover. Yeah, yeah.
The costs from the other thousands of dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it takes a person. Obviously, this doesn't work for anyone. I know so many people are like, if I don't make this Kickstarter, I can't make issue two. I just happen to be at a point in my life where, like, I have a stable job, a stable sort of situation, and I'm very good at budgeting my personal finances, and I don't spend money on lots of other stuff. I don't own a car. I like walk everywhere.
Good
I walk to work an hour every day, which is like, so it's like one of those things that, like, my wife and I, we know what we want to spend our money on. We know what we want to save for. And this is the one of those things that I'm like, this is for me a priority because I don't want to be, you know, however many years from now, you know, dying and be like, man, I wish I just made that comic, the thing that I wanted to do. I wish I did that one creative thing I told myself I wanted to do. And, you know, I didn't because I was worried about, you know, having enough money. Because I can budget for this, I'm just going to do it anyway, because this is essentially a creative project first, that if people then find it interesting, and I hope people do, you know, all the better. But if no one reads this, other than a small number of people, then, you know, maybe I'll be a little sad, but I'll still have accomplished the thing I wanted, which was making a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, that's the way I look at it for my thing. It's like, you know, I just, when I did a first issue, I just printed it up and I made it like digest size, like small. And I was like, that saved me like half the print, half the cost of like a regular sized comic. And I was like, great, Archie books are like this big, like, you know, the digests and stuff like that. And so I was like, okay, then that's what I'll do. And it came out looking like really good. And I was surprised. And I was like, why aren't all comics this size? Like, you know what I mean? Or at least all kids comics, like, you know, it's like an ash can size. So whatever you need to do.
I'm holding a copy right now of Far Sector DC Compact Comics.
Oh,
I don't know if you've seen these, but DC has started making comics that are kind of, I don't know if it's not technically manga size. It's like a little bit larger than like a standard manga. Right now they've done Hush, American Vampire, Catwoman, Wonder Woman.
You're talking about like the, like
Superman,
Watchmen and stuff like they've done, they're doing like small, like you said, like manga sized reprints, right?
Yeah. And I picked this up and it was like, oh, all of Far Sector. That's cool. I don't have a copy of Far Sector. And the sticker price is $9.99 US. So for $10, you can have a copy of Far Sector in your hand.
Yep.
Where, you know, the full size of this would probably be what, 20 something, 30? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, like, I've seen it. I was like, wow, what does this mean? What does this mean for everything? Like, I mean, obviously it's old content, right? But it's still like, it still means a lot. Like if they're putting out Watchmen for like $10, like I'm like, that's crazy. Like, you know, they've obviously made their return, but then what does that mean for, you know, absolute editions? Like, what does that mean for if you can just pick up Watchmen for $10, like, or whatever, 50, like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I saw that. I've seen those, I think at a convention or at a comic shop recently. And I was like, wow, this is great. But still, like, it's kind of crazy too. Like, you know what I mean? So in any case, well, I appreciate, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think having cheaper or free or whatever versions of things is in general a great thing.
Yeah.
Not just as a consumer, but I think it's a well-established fact that people who are collectors are into these things. Like, who's going to buy Absolute Sandman? Probably not going to be the first time someone reads Sandman, Sandman, right? So if you do a manga size Sandman or something like that, and someone's like, whoa, this is cool, I wish I had like a fancy ass hardcover book version of this, then yeah, they might get that after. I don't think there's anything bad about putting a cheaper version of something out, because the true fans and the collectors and the people who really want it will get the big version. I don't know if I'm going to do that with Upkeep, but I think that certainly if you're DC or someone who's got the time and the capital to do it, then I think it's a good way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I just think it's an interesting time in the industry. I was like, wow, this is crazy. But I appreciate you banging your drum here on Part-Time Fanboy, Ari. I really appreciate you coming back. Any final thoughts on Upkeep?
Everyone can go back it at upkeepcomic.com. Nice. That'll take you directly to the Kickstarter, upkeepcomic.com. And I'm now on Global Comics, so you can read a bunch of my comics for free, including Wardens. My strategy is going to be whenever I put out a new comic, I think I'm just going to make the other ones free.
Got it.
To read. And you can read those at Global Comics. And my name there is College Street Comics. College nice. ST Comics. So you just fire that into Global Comics. You'll see a little raccoon logo. And read whatever you like. Can you leave comments? I don't even know if you can leave comments.
I don't know. Yeah. But and where can people find you online, just like in general, besides that?
So I have a website, which is maybe redundant now that I'm moving to Global Comics, but it's at arigross.ca, arigross.ca. And you can find me on Instagram at College Street Comics, college_st_comics.
Nice, nice. Excellent. Well, thank you for coming back, Ari Gross. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's always great chatting with you.
Yeah, I love chatting with you. And I like I said, I really, really, really have enjoyed your projects. I'm looking forward to this one. I mean, I threw it some money, so everyone else should too. By the time this interview goes up, you're probably reaching like the final days of, you know, the campaign, but there's still time. You know, go to like go to Kickstarter, search for Upkeep, you know, throw it some money, help pay the mortgage, you know, whatever. But yeah, definitely go seek it out, because I mean, I like Ari's stuff, and this looks like another fun, especially for somebody like me that's like into horror or like thrillers or creepy stuff. And, you know, obviously is thinking about the things that you are thinking about, Ari. I mean, very much everyone should go help support this book. So, but thank you again for joining us, or me.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, my name is Christian Horn, and this has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out at parttimefanboy.com. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. That is working again. Thank you, Ari, for letting me know that it was not working. I recently switched host providers, but the email is working. So it's ptf@parttimefanboy.com. We are still on Facebook. We are still on Instagram. We are now on Threads as well. I still hate social media, but whatever. I just decided to join Threads because Instagram kept bothering me. I have a little webcomic called The Periwinkle Puss. You can check that out on periwinklepuss.com. Thank you for listening. Please go support Upkeep on Kickstarter. I have not read it, but it looks like something right up my alley, and I love Ari's work. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm here doing part-time. I'm here doing part-time.